committee and in informational meetings today. Colleagues, first we're going to hear from the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. I've asked the director, Tom Byler, to come and provide us with an update. And the other, I guess I'll mention this when we go to the next issue. And I'd ask Tom to talk a little bit about if you can give us an update on the acquisition program and the capital and non-capital programs. We had Parks here 2 days ago talking, giving us an update on their acquisition program as well. So I think it would be good for the committee to hear both sides of the acquisition program under Measure 66. So with that, Tom, take it away.
Thank you, Chair Dingfelder. For the record, my name is Tom Byler. I'm the Executive Director of the Oregon Watershed Enhancement Board. On my right is Roger Wood, a web staff who is our Special Projects Coordinator, who is here to talk about one of our new grant investment initiatives that is exciting to us and that we wanted to inform you on. I am prepared today to talk about the things, Chair Dingfelder, that you mentioned at some level, but also just to provide an overview of kind of the state of OWEB this biennium. And it's as a brief reminder just of who we are and what we do, I won't belabor this too much, but it is an important context for this discussion. OWEB is a relatively young agency established in 1999 by the legislature to administer half of the funds dedicated by ballot Measure 66 in 1998 that are for the purposes of watershed health, restoration of habitat for fish and wildlife, and to improve and maintain water quality. OWEB is the program that manages those dollars, and we do it through an incentive-based grant program that focuses on local voluntary cooperative conservation. We have groups such as watershed councils and soil and water conservation districts who build trust relationships with private landowners around the state to develop projects to restore habitat and improve water quality through voluntary action that we fund through our grant program. Our funds are built into, we're primarily funded with Measure 66 funds. Those Measure 66 funds, again, are based on the constitutional dedication. They are also split into two types of funding. The capital funds, which are dedicated to on-the-ground restoration and acquisition purposes. Essentially, our capital improvements involve an improvement to ecological improvements. And the remainder are for what we call non-capital purposes, which basically support the infrastructure that lead toward the restoration and on-the-ground work. 65% of our funds are capital. The remainder are non-capital. Another thing that's notable about who we are at OWEB and what we do, again, involves Measure 66, and that is that in 1998, when the voters enacted Measure 66, they gave it a 15-year horizon, and we're a little over halfway past that 15 years, and it informs and influences the way we go about doing our business. We have a sense of urgency in terms of our mission that you won't see in very many state or federal agencies, or in government for that matter, because we have a specific time window for action, and the time for us to act is now. At the outset, I'm pleased to report that things are good at OWEB. To put it in the most simple ways, we have great dedicated staff who work very hard and are very passionate about what they do. We have great and dedicated and passionate stakeholders who are also very dedicated in what they do. Our success for us is working on projects where everyone is happy. And we have a lot of win-win stories that we can tell in terms of the investments we've made over the years. It's quite a transition from, I guess one way to look at our program is it builds community around watershed health. It brings people together around solving natural resources issues rather than resolving those issues through regulation and what can be more polarizing types of situations. So in terms of the state of where we're at, one observation I would have is that there's a real building wave of interest in what we do. People are across the state acting voluntarily and with councils and districts to put this kind of work together. We're seeing more and more people join in on these efforts, and we still have a steep hill to climb. We have a lot of people we need to connect with and want to connect with, but we see traction, and we see that that's evolving in a very positive way. The second positive thing that we have is increasing lottery funds. With the legislative budget that we received for this biennium, we're thrilled at the opportunity that it provides. And I'll give you some context. In 1999, the 99-01 budget cycle, OWIP had $19 million of capital funds to distribute for the restoration and acquisition grants. This biennium, we have $64 million to distribute. That's a big increase, and it creates wonderful opportunities for us to invest in conservation around the state. Interestingly enough, at the same time, with those same budgets, in 99-01, non-capital funds for our grant program, we had $12 million. This biennium, we have about the same. And that number remains static. And there are reasons for that. One is that a good portion of the Measure 66 non-capital funds go directly to support programs within other agencies. And another piece of why that number has stayed relatively static is that we've relied in the past on federal funds to fund a lot of our non-capital investments, and those dollars are diminishing as well. Lastly, on the points of goodness that we have at OWEB is that our investments are paying off. We're not only are we've, as I mentioned, our key stakeholders are being very successful in working with folks, and we're seeing that translate into our grant program. Essentially, we received 264 grant applications in the current pending cycle that we have. It was from September to March this year. Our board will consider awards in March. 264 applications. That was eye-popping for our staff and a little worrisome for me as a manager, because that's a 25% increase over the previous high. And it's significant workload for us to solicit, review, and make recommendations to our board in terms of navigating those applications through a good process. And in addition, the requested funds as part of that 264 applications was over $33 million. To give context on that, 10 years ago, when you bundle all of the grant cycles that OWEB had for that period of time, the two-year period, $33 million was the total over a two-year period. Now we just have one grant cycle where that total request is the same. Now, also to give you context, is that of that $33 million of requests, we've earmarked and reserved as part of our grant budget about $12 million for that cycle. So we're not going to meet the demand. At the same time, I would point out that not all of those $33 million worth of requests are going to pass muster with our review team either. So it's going to be somewhere in between. In terms of acquisitions, Chair Dingfelder had specifically asked about that, and in general terms, I would say that we're seeing a very significant uptick of interest in acquisitions within our program. In past years, the standard for our staff is to have kind of an ongoing queue of applications for acquisitions that was in very low numbers, around 2 to 5 applications in play at any given point in time. Those are all very time-consuming projects because you're dealing with the transfer of land. But right now, we have a record high of applications in the queue of 11. And these are significant projects. They are for projects in different parts of the state. They involve these are applications from third parties for, in some cases, fee title conservation easements, and others that they're working easements where those lands would continue to be in production. For example, in Northeast Oregon, there's a grant in the queue right now which proposes to have a working ranch that would be based on sustainable principles that are more striving to be friendly to the environment. So we've got a wide range of those applications coming in, and my expectation is that our investments will be up by the end of this biennium, that you'll see a stronger investment than you've ever seen from OWEB. With acquisitions, we don't earmark a budget for that. It's part of the pool of capital dollars, and we're dependent upon folks coming in with applications for those types of projects. So we're growing as an agency. We're getting more demand. That's good news for us. We, you know, that's our whole purpose is to have stakeholders who are out there working successfully with their communities to develop projects for us to consider. It does raise issues for us internally in terms of how we respond to that growth. And I want to talk about how we're evolving a little bit in three areas. One part of that is not just we've responded to the programmatic growth and from an administration standpoint, but also in terms of the mindset that we try to bring to our agency as we do our business. As I mentioned, we're a young agency and we are growing. We're a lot larger agency. We're still small by most agency standards, but we're a lot larger than we were 10 years ago. And we have this 15-year work window. That does create a sense of urgency for us. And the way that we like to approach our business is that we're always asking ourselves, are we doing the best we can with what we have? And that we would ask that question of ourselves, whether we have $2 million to spend or $60 million to spend. It's hugely important. And the stakes for us are high because we have a great responsibility for being stewards of these dollars. The dollars are significant, and the potential for benefit of the ecological outcomes that we're investing in are also significant to our communities around the state as well. In terms of managing increased workload, as I mentioned earlier, reviewing, soliciting and reviewing grants and managing open grants that are in progress is a core function for our agency. And I want to give you some context around that by telling you about a conversation I had with our field staff person from Central Oregon, who's been around OWEB before it was OWEB, when it was the Governor's Watershed Enhancement Board, and has seen it grow from a relatively small program into what it is today. Back in the day, we had a statewide review team, and that review team looked at all the applications that we received across the state. And there came a point in time when the workload for that review team, by the way, the review team is comprised of volunteers from other public agencies who have expertise in fisheries, in forest health, in rangeland management. We depend on those folks very much to give us recommendations on the merit of the projects, of the applications as they come in. And that statewide review team, historically, found itself bursting at the seams in terms of workload. And so what happened is that the agency decided to split the state into five regions, and each region had its own review team to deal with the workload issue. Well, the catalyst that made that change was when the statewide review team had 60 applications to review. For this current pending cycle, three of our five regions have 60-plus applications to review. That's a red flag for me, and so we're taking measures to try to address that. And one fortunate thing that I can report to you today and thank you all for is that in our budget that we received for this session, we were given position authority to hire an additional field staff person. And we're in the process now of developing a sixth region in the state, likely on the east side at this point. And we hope to have that in play and in in place, I should say, before the end of this year. We're also looking at whether we can enhance our presence on the west side as well, because we have a lot of grants that we're managing on that side of the state as well. Again, in terms of our evolution, what we and mindset, we're always looking to be as smart as we can in what we do, and we know that we're not going to where we can't provide enough staff, we need to look for ways to help our staff and our stakeholders get the job done effectively. So we've made investments over the years, and especially in recent years, and again, thanks to the legislature, in our data services. We have improved our database. We now have are working toward and have put into place a website, online access to our data, which is a very comprehensive database of conservation actions, which is very useful for practitioners and stakeholders and policymakers who are interested in what we do. We also have put online a grant system that will help for the management of grants, both for our staff in terms of understanding the ongoing workload and being able to understand whether there are reporting deadlines or whether amendments need to be made to open grants, but even more importantly for our grantees, so they can access the data system on the grants and be able to know where their grants are and what responsibilities they have under those agreements. Another point that I'd like to make is that along the lines of data and information, it's extremely important for us as we go down this 15-year path that we provide information that's useful for the public and for policymakers. That what's critical for us is to make sure that we have the monitoring in place to be able to understand the return on the investments that we're making over time. And those investments are going to be significant by the time we get to our 15th year. And that we also help folks understand what the return is on those investments, which is a tough task, to be frank. Understanding we've struggled with that and continue to struggle with that, not only at OWEB, but I think among all state agencies and from the science standpoint, being able to understand, you know, when have we reached the point where we say we've done our job and we can walk away. It's not that simple for us. It's an ongoing learning curve for us, and we're striving, though, to do the best we can with the knowledge base that we have and with the information that we have. A last point I'd like to make, and this is where you can stop listening to me and maybe listen from Roger here, is we don't sit in our hands and rely on our current investment or past investment structures as the best way of doing business in terms of our grant program. We're constantly asking ourselves, are there better ways for us to get the dollars on the ground to achieve strong restoration results, strong conservation results? And we have a number of programs that we've enacted in the past that are outside of our regular grant program. Typically, when I talk about a grant program, I'm talking about the numbers that you heard earlier, which is our competitive grant program that is really based on a grassroots basis where local groups develop they assess the conditions of the watershed and they develop their priorities and then compete with other areas around the state in terms of OWEB funding. I wanted to talk a little bit with you about an effort that we've initiated this biennium called the Special Investment Partnerships that Roger Wood here has been key to helping us put forward. And it's a little bit different than our regular grant program in a number of ways. We basically asked ourselves in developing this program, are there ways that we can achieve significant ecological outcomes on a larger scale than we've been achieving through our regular grant program? Are there ways that we can take local partnerships to a new level? And in this case, we're looking at not only relying on the important aspect of local groups developing consensus or partnerships with landowners and other members of the community for projects that we engage in, but we're now looking at a larger scale where we're asking and getting interest from groups to think outside of their own watershed and to develop priorities and partnerships at a larger basin scale. And we'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute with what we're starting to do in the Deschutes. The other aspect of the special investment partnerships is to leverage funding in a way that to increase leverage of funding. Now, our current grants require a minimum of 25% match to our regular grant program. Our grantees often exceed that. But through the special investment partnership, OWEB is playing a more proactive role in this by providing a larger amount of funding with an intent for a longer-term commitment, with the idea that money and that the amount of that money will have a gravitational force to other big funders that are out there, and we've to look for opportunities for us to match other efforts that are ongoing, and that's one of the things that we'll talk about in a minute on the Deschutes. It's something that we're looking at in the Willamette as well, and we have some other areas we're focusing on too. last two points is that we're focusing, again, this is still maintaining the cooperative conservation element. It's still abiding by the overarching principles that guide us. And very last point is that we funded our first SIP project in the Deschutes. Just last month, our board awarded $4 million for a group of stakeholders in the Upper Deschutes Watershed Council, Crooked River Watershed Council, the Deschutes Basin Land Trust, and the Deschutes Resource Conservancy, among other partners, to leverage investments being made associated with the Pelton Round Butte Dam relicensing, where we would not be focused on that specifically, but be looking at being additive to what they're doing in terms of restoring habitat. With the chance and hopefully probability that we'll see anadromous salmon and steelhead above that dam in the coming years. The project will also benefit water quality and native fish already there. But it's an exciting arena for us. Our board is excited about it. We're working hard on developing a similar type of approach with some different nuances in the Willamette. We're also looking at the Rogue Basin. We're looking at the Oregon coast in terms of estuaries. The Klamath Basin may be an area where we focus this type of energy as well. So it's additive to what we do with our regular grant program, and I'm happy to say that because of the increased revenue, we can do both, and without taking one from the other, we can continue to have a regular competitive grant program, but we can also move forward with these strategic investments like the SIP. So with that, Chair Dingfelder, I feel like I was a bit of a machine gun in terms of rattling off my items, and if you have any questions for me, I'd be happy to take them now, or if you'd like Roger to talk a little bit more detail about the Deschutes project, we'd be happy to do that as well.
Actually, I have a couple of questions before we go into detail about Deschutes, but I definitely want to hear about that. And I was going to say my vice chair cannot complain that we're not doing enough for Deschutes Basin since they're the first.
I was trying to keep that on the
radar. I already knew, but it's great. He's already getting his fly fishing rod ready for his way. Two questions. One is, as you know, our lottery revenue is declining right now, and it has been growing at a very high rate, and you certainly have, I should say, OWEB and watersheds have benefited from that. Do you have sort of a plan looking at declining revenues from Measure 66, and given that we're getting more and more grant requests, how we're going to manage that expectation?
Chair Dingfelder, excellent question. I wish I had an excellent answer in response, other than managing expectations is going to be very important. And I think a lot of our stakeholders, most of them have been around the block a few times, and they understand that the resources don't match the demand. But there it is an important point for us to communicate with our stakeholders. The other thing for us to do is to work as hard as we can to leverage our investments as best we can. That's part of what the SIP program is all about, is leveraging investments. Although federal funds are diminishing too, there is still a chance for us to we're not going to just sit on our hands and wait for that federal money to come our way. We're going to be aggressively looking for opportunities to partner with federal agencies that have resources that we can match and make our dollars go further, as well as look at federal grants as opportunities. The other thing that we're doing, and this is particular to the Willamette, and this is new to our business, is that we're talking more with private foundations who are expressing increasing interest in watershed health. And specifically on the Willamette, we've been working very closely with the Meyer Memorial Trust, who has signaled their interest over the next 10 to 15 years to invest in the Willamette. And so our goal is to not only work with Meyer in the Willamette, but hopefully to leverage a consortium of funders that above and beyond that, there would be public and private entities.
Thank you. Representative Burley has a question on that.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Tom, I mean, what can I say? Thanks. That money on the SIP is just going to go a long, long way, and we're really excited in the Upper Deschutes Basin there, as far as trying to get the steelhead and salmon established. And but I do have one thing, and I'll bet you probably would never have suspected this would come up today. But As you know, I'm on the board for the Upper Deschutes Watershed Council, and at our last board meeting, the discussion of Senate Bill 10 came up, and whether or not it's applicable to board members on these watershed councils. And I've got a request in the LC to try and get some clarification on that, but I don't know if that's something OREB could help facilitate as well, but I think if, in fact, they are subject to it, I think it'd be helpful to get the word out to them all that they need to be aware of what that bill does.
Chair Dingfelder, Vice Chair Burley, thank you. I actually was expecting potential for that question. I'd heard that that had been asked, and it's a fair question. I'm not in a position to opine on it one way or the other, although I would hope that given that most watershed councils, they can be organized in a variety of different ways, but increasingly most of them are 501c3 nonprofit organizations. And we certainly at OWEB view them as independent entities. That we would work with, as we would work with other NGOs such as Oregon Trout or the Nature Conservancy. But their status is a little bit different. They're unique. They're very unique. And they were born out of statutory guidance, and they're recognized by local government, and they have a significant amount of state funding that go to them. So they're unique entities, and I don't think there's a clear answer to the question. I think it's a fair question to ask, and certainly one that we would want to be helpful with, okay, with you and others to get the word out once we have a sense of what the answer is.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Good question.
More of just a comment.
Mm-hmm.
Tom and his staff over the past several years have just done a really remarkably good job in helping with the water problems in the Klamath Basin. So I just like to give you credit, Tom, as again, you and your staff have done a great job, and we appreciate it.
Great. Thank you for that positive feedback. Any other questions? Representative
Cameron? Thank you, Madam Chair. I guess, Tom, this is sort of a question about your thoughts perhaps on a lazy Sunday afternoon, not necessarily in preparation for coming to face us. But I sort of thinking broadly, do you have any thoughts on whether the OWEB model, which is so unique and successful, could be a model for other state endeavors, including but not limited to sort of ecological projects? I mean, we had this, I think, really great creature with a significant track record of success. Do you ever think about how this might be broadened?
Chair Dingfelder, Representative Kim, I do, and I hear from folks from outside of the state interested in our model. People know about us, especially in the conservation and restoration communities in other parts of the country. In fact, other parts of the world. We've had folks from Soviet Union. Boy, that dates me a little bit, doesn't it? From Russia. Sakhalin Island interested in our model of conservation. It really resonates with people. You know, the bottom line, though, is the Measure 66 money. This wouldn't be happening without this state commitment of funding. It absolutely would not happen unless we had that. And and as I look at what we've been able to accomplish compared to other states, we are exceeding those other states by far in on-the-ground work, and the results are really eye-popping. But it's really because of these state funds. But getting back to your point, I think it's a model that, while it has its imperfections and doesn't work everywhere, and it really relies on the right kind of people being there in the communities at the right time, it is something that I think is very strong. When it works, it's a powerful thing to witness, and it would be something I'd be interested to have conversations about with folks who are interested in other states, or to try to leverage this kind of model to other issues as well.
Thank you. We only have a couple minutes left because we have Department of Agriculture here who's going to provide an update on the biofuels bill and the ethanol rule. So, Roger, if you can sort of wrap up, that would be great.
I shall. And I came, as much as anything else, to be prepared to answer questions in detail about the Deschutes, and can do that now, could do it any other time. there are 25 or 26 projects that the partnership there has agreed will be the first and second tier of projects for funding this biennium, and we hope next biennium, because the board doesn't commit its funding, of course, ahead of this biennium, but there's an intention stated by the board to keep up with this and to look for money in the next biennium to share with the folks in the Deschutes as well as any other SIP projects to get started in the short run. You know, I do want to say something on top of that last comment of Tom's. I am as old as I look, and I have been around this G-Web, O-Web thing essentially since the beginning, as Committee Administrator Petrino can attest. She's not as old as she is.
The chair's been around about as long as it is.
She's not as old as
I knew it when it was Swim G.
I will say that there's always been public funding for this, but in the first biennium, it was $500,000. Mm-hmm. And in the second biennium, I think it was $1 million of general fund. And back in those days, what we were doing was working to fund and carry out demonstration projects that showed folks how they could do what needed to be done and where some of the partnerships and other funding might come from. That was very useful, but that was a demonstration project, very limited number of them. Since Measure 66, we're actually taking the lead in helping people fix problems throughout whole basins, unplug all the culverts or replace all the culverts that are fish passage barriers in a particular basin, so that at the end of a few years and a few million dollars worth of work, we've actually finished that and fixed it, one hopes forever. So that funding is critical. I do want to say also, in response to Representative Cannon's question a moment ago, that some of what SIP is looking forward to doing in the biennia ahead is initiating those special kinds of partnerships that center around issues that are just too complicated or daunting to ever come through the regular grant process. And an example of that would be biomass utilization, or you can talk about it in terms of excess fire fuels in our forests. You can talk about it in terms of the encroachment of juniper on the rangelands, but it all comes back to biomass. It's the sort of thing that we don't get a lot of grant proposals to deal with other than a few acres at a time, but there's a potential for us to invest or to make a promise to invest some number of millions of dollars of OWEB funding, and that becomes a magnet. That bag of money on the table, if you will, becomes a magnet that attracts other folks in and that gives us all an incentive and maybe some hope to sit together and work on a solution to the larger problem. OWEB can't provide all the funding, we can't provide all the leadership, but we can help get things going through an initiative like the SIP, and that's something that we're looking forward to doing in the years and months ahead, is address the biomass issue with all the people out there who themselves are addressing it and maybe could use our help. So in brief, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just wanted to say make those remarks and offer myself to the committee, Representative Burley, anyone else at another time, perhaps to drill more deeply into the Deschutes SIP details if you wish.
Well, thank you, gentlemen, and we will be asking you to come back and make updates to us, especially on the SIP program, but appreciate you coming here today on such short notice as
no
well.
Problem.
And it's really good to get updates, and I encourage members, if they have additional questions or want to get more specific information, I'm sure Mr. Byler would be happy to provide that.
Not only that, Chair Dingfelder, I do thank you for the time today and would be happy to take any of you on when you have a free moment out to see projects that we've funded and meet some of the councils and landowners that we work with. It's a pretty amazing experience.
Well, and as you know, we did incorporate that into our tour in October. We had several of our members there, and we will try to do that as we're planning some field hearings this fall.
Great.
So we'll definitely
great.
Have Beth coordinate with you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And next, I'm going to ask the Department of Agriculture to come up and give us an update on House Bill 2210 rulemaking. And colleagues, you have a press release on your desk that I asked Beth to share with you. This came from Pacific Ethanol. And last session, when we were working on the biofuels bill, we talked a lot about cellulosic ethanol and said, you know, wouldn't it be great if we had the money to do research and have a plant here in Oregon? And it sounds like it's actually coming our way. The U.S. Department of Energy has included the plant in Boardman that opened up. I was there, I guess, last winter when that opened up. It's in Representative Smith's district. And the plant will actually look at cellulosic ethanol. Now the feedstock is from corn, and they're going to be looking at wheat straw, wood chips, and corn stover. And that's going to be processed at the existing site. This is really good news because we haven't had the funding in Oregon in order to do that type of research. So if you want to also mention anything about it, that would be helpful. But I want to hear updates. Yeah.
Just to let you know, I'm fortunate, as you know, to be one of the ex officio members of the Oregon Innovation Council, and we receive media clips that are relevant from time to time. Just to let you know, this was prominent among those emails and has been a source of celebration among the Oregon Inc. members, too. So, way to go.
Well, it's really exciting. I am pleased to see that the federal government is investing dollars in this research because we don't have the capabilities here, as you know, and that was a lot of the discussions we had last session around the biofuels bill. So thanks for coming today, again, on such short notice to provide us with an update. I know you've been working very hard. I've been getting emails from you many times a week, which is very helpful because I get a lot of emails from constituents, as many of us do, as the ethanol rulemaking process went through. So if you could provide us with an update, and also I think it would be important to also talk about the biofuels component of that, because I know that rulemaking will be, I don't know if it started yet, but I know it will be soon. So the biodiesel component, because the ethanol, you know, we've heard a lot about that, and the biodiesel component has not started up yet.
Sure. Members of the committee, I'm Lisa Hansen, Deputy Director with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Thank you for the opportunity to visit with you about the implementation of 2210. With me is Russ Wyckoff, the Administrator of our Weights and Measures Division, as well as Mark Kendall from the Department of Energy, who has worked with us as we've gone through this process. And so hopefully between Russ and Mark, they can answer many of your technical questions. I think what I'll do is just go ahead, if it is acceptable to you, have Russ walk through the work that we've done since we visited with you. I think it's been about 2 months ago when we gave you an update on our progress and what's happened since then.
Chair Dean Felder, members of the committee, once again, I'm Russ Wyckoff, Department of Agriculture Measurement Standards. We do appreciate the opportunity to give you a progress report on where the Department of Agriculture is on the permanent rule for House Bill 2210. We had a permanent rule public hearing, and that was conducted on January 24th of 08. There was a seven-day written comment period that ended on the 31st of January. This week, the hearings officer should complete the report on the hearing, and that will be available to the Director of Agriculture next week for review. To kind of give you a summary of what this permanent rule proposed, it defines the geographical areas and implementation dates for the 10% ethanol mandate. It clarifies dispenser labeling requirements for E10 and E85. And it clarifies that autogas used exclusively in aircraft approved for using autogas would not be subject to the 10% ethanol blending requirements. The permanent rule does not include the biodiesel portion of House Bill 2210. There's still items to be clarified on the biodiesel portion. The information that we have from the biodiesel production facilities in the state indicate that first quarter of 2009 would be before the requirement of B2 would come into effect. We plan to start public advisory work groups in late March to develop rules as needed for the implementation of the biodiesel requirement, and the permanent rules would be developed and well in place prior to the estimated 09 implementation date. If I can answer more questions, I'd be glad to.
Madam Chair, can I just get a repetition of the piece of the permanent rule that was related to aircraft? Again, if you can just repeat that.
Well, actually, I was going to ask you to go into a little bit more detail on that element because we've had a lot of constituent contact and from other members. And so I think what would be helpful, first I just want to do an overview, then I'd like Russ to talk a little bit about the background and what some of the issues have been and how you've resolved that. So just want to see if there are any other general questions about the rulemaking and how that process is. I'm just curious, did you get a lot of input on the rulemaking for the ethanol?
We actually held 5 advisory work groups that were open to the public, and one of these was dedicated to aviation, and we had a sign-up sheet where we requested anyone that was at this public meeting that had aviation-related questions, and we set up a separate meeting along with the Department of Aviation and Dan Klim and his crew. We tried to address those questions there. We will go over those for you. What we had at the actual permanent rulemaking hearing is everybody who was there testified did have questions about aviation. That was predominantly the issue that they had questions about. There was some confusion, and they didn't understand exactly what it did. What we did prior to starting the public hearing is I held a 1-hour question and answer period, and we addressed those people at that time. Answered all their questions. When we actually opened the public testimony, we only had 2 individuals in that testified. I think we answered the people's questions at that question and answer period.
Okay, Representative Burley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Russ, if I understand what you're saying, this particular rulemaking covered the E10 V2 stuff.
That's
in
correct.
General, but was there any other rulemaking necessary under 2210, for example, with the biomass tax collector credits and those types of things, or was this the only portion of that bill that required the administrative
rule? Can we refer that to Mark Kendall with the tax credit?
Members of the committee, Chair Dingfelder and Representative Burley, the Oregon Department of Energy has conducted a rulemaking, administrative rulemaking, and we had 2 advisory group meetings and then 1 public hearing regarding the consumer credits. And if you recall, the consumer credits in House Bill 2210 provided incentives that were a self-administered credit claimed when you file your taxes for the use of B20 or biodiesel at 20% concentrations for home heating, E85 or ethanol at 85% concentration for automotive use, and B99 biodiesel at 99% concentrations for vehicle use, as well as $10 per ton for prepared dried woody biomass for space heating. Those rules are in place and completed. Another attribute of House Bill 2210 was what you referred to, Representative Burley, was the producers and collectors credit. And the producers and collectors credits initially were introduced in the engrossed version of House Bill 2210 to be defined by rulemaking and were later articulated quite specifically in statute by the legislature. And a rulemaking was not indicated. The Department of Energy, though, did hold a meeting of interested parties and published it on our website, as well as solicited participation by people who had been engaged in either the legislation or inquiries with the department. And we developed an advisory. And this is an advisory. It's a prudent person advisory because those credits, too, are self-administered. They were specific cents per pound for seed oil crops or $10 per ton for woody biomass or $5 per ton for green waste that's used as biofuel feedstock. And those that advisory talked about what would look like a very reliable and accountable receipting method for a consumer who's or a collector, and what are the mechanisms. We worked with Revenue Department, and they devised a transfer form that enables a collector that has no appetite for a state of Oregon credit to transfer that credit one time to another party. So those are available, the advisory, the transfer for the collector's credits. We've had a significant amount of interest and activity relating to woody biomass. A number of Oregon logging companies and logging services companies are beginning to mine or slash piles that are relatively easily accessible, and were otherwise slated for just field burning. So we're seeing an increase in activity, interest, and stewardship activities.
Yes, thank you. I really do want to thank the department, all the departments, but this biomass, you're right, I was in Lakeview 2 weeks ago in Roseburg last week in some meetings, and this was definitely the buzz in those meetings. A lot of people were talking about how these biomass tax collector credits are really driving them to get out and start cleaning up some of this stuff that ordinarily we would have just left in the woods. So really, it's good to see that we get something like this passed. Now, I would also caution, though, we need to watch that, because the actual tax expenditures may become pretty significant if it.
I was going to add a follow-up. I think it would be helpful for here, and certainly you'll be doing that, I would imagine. We have a member of the Revenue Committee here, so possibly with the Revenue Committee. It's regular reports. I don't know, for 07, it's not going to be a full-year reporting. But it would be helpful to know, what the growth and how much we're looking at for the tax credit. Because I know when we drafted the bill, there were estimates about what the fiscal impact would be. And so I think it's going to be really important to track that and get the actual numbers.
I would add to that, and again, it's probably more suited to the Revenue Committee for this kind of discussion, but some understanding of the effect of the tax credits on the market, as Chuck Burley was, Representative Burley was suggesting, like what has its effect been on consumers? Is it doing what we expected? Are the levels that were set in the bill, do we need to revisit those in 2009? My guess would be yes. I didn't like the fact that we put those particular price points in the bill, or the Revenue Committee put those particular prices in the bill in the first place. Presumably, there may be some need to come back in 09 and make sure they're doing what we intended them to do. Well, perhaps they're doing more than we intended, in which case they need to be lower. So, let's add to that.
Yes, Chair Dingfelder, Representative Cannon and Burley, and members of the committee, the department is also charged in House Bill 2210 with an analysis and study and evaluation of the impacts and influences of these credits on the marketplace, whether it's employment or whether it's the bone-dry tons recovered and reused or displaced fossil fuels and emissions, and it also includes revenue impacts. The Department of Revenue did not have the capability to assign a credit number to this specific tax credit, but there are methods that we are using and developing to maintain the record keeping on the relative volumes, and we'll have a confidence interval developed after we do our first survey. But we have conducted surveys of all of in the past there were 58, now there's about 62 woody biomass users in the state. We know who the biodiesel producers are that are going to be drawing in the seed oil crops, and we do know who will be specifically the first initiators of cellulosic ethanol conversion, which would be claiming those credits. So it's a confined market at the production and use ends, and we'll be able to replicate a previous survey that was quite comprehensive that we've done every other biennium, and get contact with those people and be able to report that. And that survey is they're being developed and put in place for data collection through the end of 2007 this spring.
Great. Last question, then we have to move on to aviation.
Okay. Yeah, just quickly, Mark, you said that the Department of Revenue could not or did not assign a credit number. What does that mean?
Other credits or credits that are claimed on the other credit line on a 1040 form by an individual or by a corporation are often ascribed an indicator or a number that indicates what specific credit, whether it's pollution control or otherwise. There was not the ability under circumstances that I am not informed about. That's the other department.
As to why that wasn't applicable or appropriate under this circumstance. But that tracks the credit at the hedgerow by hedgerow, claimant by claimant. And we will be very well informed about how much of these feedstocks have shown up at our bioenergy facilities, because that's where we'll be surveying. So we'll be able to get the relative number of eligible feedstocks that showed up at biomass facilities, because they are few in number and manageable to research.
Okay, thanks.
So I should just point out, one of the things that you mentioned was the Pacific ethanol transition to cellulosic ethanol. That organization's choice to locate in Oregon, and then their continuous push for the lowest carbon footprint biofuel, was what attracted U.S. Department of Energy to funding their project. Several of the rigorous criteria in that grant application process included infrastructure, demand creation, as well as other interest in the project. And the other interest is characterized as by state or public interest. And Oregon's renewable fuel standard, Oregon's tax incentives for woody biomass and other materials to provide incentives for feedstocks, as well as the other marketplace infrastructure being prepared to accept different fuels, were critical in them being able to get a grant. There were five issued nationally. They got one. And so it's a very select club. And I think Oregon should claim some credit for showing interest.
Great. Well, thank you. I'm very pleased to see this when it came across my desk last week. So appreciate your help with that. And I'm sure we'll have you come back and give some more updates, especially on the tax credits. And one of the things that colleagues is, we debated about what feedstocks to include in the bill. And it occurs to me, we may want to come back and make some changes if we're finding some feedstocks, folks aren't using, and that there's other feedstocks out there we may want to look at. So with that, I think we'll move on to the aviation part, and then we're going to be out of time because we get kicked out of this room. So if you can give a little more background specifically in the aviation piece of the biofuels rulemaking.
Senator Dingfeld, members of the committee, I'll try to give you a quick walkthrough on what we're talking about. When we started our rulemaking process, it quickly became evident that there was an issue with aviation, not only with safety, but with the availability of getting non-ethanol gasoline. I don't think that was anyone's intent. I don't think anyone was aware of that previously. As soon as it became an issue with us, we had a number of calls, complaints. We got a hold of Dan Klim with the Department of Aviation, who came on board with us. They were involved in our rulemaking process. We had legal counsel that looked at House Bill 2210, and the determination from legal counsel was that avgas used in airplane was not included in this bill. Auto gas that was used exclusively for aircraft was also not included in this bill. And so what we attempted to do through our rule was clarify that through pump labeling, that there would be non-ethanol gas for aviation available. Now, whether the infrastructure is there to do it, I know Dan Klim and Aviation could speak on that. They've been working very hard on getting airports involved and trying to get a supply to the people so there would be that availability. The proposed rule would allow the selling of non-ethanol gasoline for aircraft to use aviation, and that's what we attempted to resolve through this rule.
Thank you. And Mr. Klim, if you can add to that, that would be helpful.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dan Klim, Director of the Department of Aviation. We've been working with some of the fuel distributors who do not traditionally sell avgas, aviation fuel, or jet fuel to airports. We have found two fuel distributors, Carson Oil and I believe Reinhardt, who have said, yes, we're willing saying, we see a marketplace opportunity here, and yes, we're willing to provide non-blended, premium-grade gasoline. The first delivery has been made to the Lebanon State Airport, where the commercial fuel operator at that airport is preparing now the dispensers and the pricing structure to be able to sell unblended premium gasoline for use in aircraft only. So it's a difficult position for a fuel distributor because the availability of unblended premium may not be there in the future, and the volume is now shifting from what was the neighborhood gas station to a few select airports in Oregon. There are, we believe, anywhere from probably 300 to 500 aircraft in Oregon where the engine has either been modified or was manufactured such that it can't take ethanol, more than 5% of ethanol. We are working with the manufacturers to determine that while your manufacturer specifications say that you can't burn more than 5% ethanol in the fuel, there have been airplanes in the Portland area in the winter months who have been flying for years with more than that. Getting the manufacturer to change their specifications isn't likely, but to in fact inform and identify those kinds of engines that have been burning on blended, if you will, gasoline is something that we're also working on as well. So right now it looks as though we'll have one or two airports that will be able to provide the unblended premium, at least in the short run. There are attendant issues of how long will that be able to be possible. There are attendant issues for those folks who have purchased specialized technical certificates known as STCs. Their airplane came with a requirement to burn 100 low lead. They decided and modified their engines and received through FAA procedures this certificate which allows them to burn a different fuel than what the engine was originally manufactured for. They paid somewhere up to $1,400 for each one of these certificates so that they could burn regular car gas, which is about $1.50 cheaper a gallon. So they made some investment with regard to these technical certificates, and now if they can't get unblended premium gasoline for those airplanes, those certificates to Sembergate could be worthless to them. So we're doing what we can to work with the fuel distributors. Many of them are saying, I can't put in a third set of tanks at the local gas station or can't carry a third trailer. So it's a real problem for a number of small aircraft owners. The Experimental Aviation Associations, there are chapters on many of Oregon's airports. We're working closely with them and with the Oregon Pilots Association to educate, inform, and work with the fuel distributors to do what we can to continue to provide a source of fuel for them.
Thank you. I will say, colleagues, we did not hear during all the hearings we didn't hear this as an issue until several months ago when you were going through the rulemaking. I think was the first time that it came up. And we had multiple public hearings. I did not receive one email. Certainly, it's unfortunate that there's a that has been impacted, that it's an unintended consequence. And we appreciate the fact that you're doing everything you can to work with the aircraft users to try to come up with a solution. And certainly hope that we're able to find something where you can provide, you know, we don't want to undermine the safety, obviously, of aviators in Oregon. But I know you've been working hard to try to resolve that, and I do appreciate it. And certainly many of us are aware of that and have been contacted, so I do appreciate that. I don't know if you want to just mention about the Senate amendment that was put in bill, Senate Bill 1079. You've gotten a chance to look that over. I don't know if you testified on that.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, that passed out of the Senate Trans Committee Tuesday with the Dash 2 amendment that you have in front of you. The word aircraft was added as essentially being exempt from the requirement that a retailer may sell unblended gasoline for use in motor vehicles that are used off-road, for lawn tools and chainsaws, and then the word aircraft was added. We testified that that isn't going to change the fuel distribution system, but at least it will send us the signal that there's not a barrier to being able to do that. What we're really seeing here is a shift of where the inventory was at the neighborhood gas station to a couple of airports, and this makes it clear that aircraft use for unblended gasoline is legal.
And as you mentioned, blended ethanol gasoline has been used in certain parts of the state for many years, and you have not heard complaints from pilots in the, I guess it would be Medford and Portland area during the winter months?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, that is correct. We have not heard of incidents or complaints that that was an issue. As those previous laws had those oxygenation requirements during the winter months, those are generally the months they don't fly, and particularly the smaller aircraft. So it's probably likely that I wouldn't have heard complaints, at least in years past.
Okay, well, thank you for that update. Any other questions before we adjourn for the week? Okay, well, thank you very much. Really appreciate it, and I'm sure we'll be wanting to hear more about the biodiesel, I'm going to get that right this time, as that process moves forward as well. With that, we will close the informational meeting on House Bill 2110 and close the hearing on the House Energy and Environment Committee, and we're meeting next Monday. See you tomorrow off. Next Monday at 1 o'clock. Yeah. Thank you.